Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. Bit of a special edition of the podcast. This was a pretty unplanned over here. Basically, I was looking at the podcast list and the dates, and we're about a year in, actually, in the podcast. It's been surprising to me. I didn't realize it's March 23rd, so it's been exactly a year, and depending when you were listening to this. So I decided that it would be good to offer some reflections on the past year of the podcast, how that's gone and its reception and what I've learned from it and all that. And also just maybe to introduce myself a little bit again. I can refer people back to the introduction show, so to speak, that I did at one point. And there's also the original show that I did. I talked a little bit, but maybe it's better just refresh. There's some new listeners. Maybe people don't know. So just refresh and go over that. Now, I was going to do this myself, which I've done a few shows, but I think being that this became an interview program and that I guess that facilitates the conversation a bit better, so I decided to bring on a friend and a listener to interview me on my own podcast, and we'll see how that goes.
Okay, can you hear me? All right, I'm going to echo Nachi's welcome to everybody to the next episode of Svarim Chatter podcast. Although being as this is discussing Svarim Chatter, not Svarim, I think this is the Svarim Chatter podcast. So let's start with a little, why don't you tell us about yourself, not a little background, how you got into Svarim, and then we'll start talking about the Twitter and the podcast. So go for it.
Okay. So like I said, I've said some of this before, but you know, chazer some of it or people that didn't hear it. I don't know how interesting I am, but I'll say it for the listeners that want to hear. So I'm from Lakewood originally, and regular Lakewood education. I went to Passaic Misifta, Misifta Passaic, under Meir Rubin, and I learned in for Bais Medrash. I learned in Philadelphia Yeshiva, Philly, and then I was in Eretz Yisrael for a little, and then I was in BMG for in Kehl for a number of years. I'm currently in law school. That's the basics on that. Now, Svarim wise. How I got into Svarim is, I don't know. My grandfather's very into Svarim. It's called Rabbi Kusil Weinstein. It's a shul in Lakewood, Chevre Lamdi Torah, otherwise known as
a famous librarian in that shul.
A famous librarian. That only came later, but yeah. So I am the librarian there, or the Gabbai Svarim, whatever you want to call it. And it's a good, I think. I'm obviously in the game with over. People should check it out. And so when I was still in Misifta and I was in high school in Passaic, I got into a very small, it's only Misifta, so it's a small Eitzer. So I started doing this farm there. When I got to Philly, I was in charge of this farm there. And I gradually got into this farm. I mean, I've said this probably a number of times. I always tell people I got into it by taking all the critical edition of Rishonim and earlier Sfarim, taking, the Mosar of Kook, the Machon Yerushalayim, Avat Shalom, even Zichron Aharon, and taking where they have, Mavui there and doing that. Obviously, Shem HaGdolim. I wrote about that in Mishpacha magazine in Chanukah, so I read the Shem HaGdolim from the Chidah. I got into Svarim that way, and gradually I got into history and Svarim. I should mention that I had a teacher in 10th grade, Meir Birnbaum in Passaic. He wrote The Pathway to Prayer, is how he's famously known, but he actually teaches Jewish history. He actually told us he wasn't teaching us history, he was teaching us Maseiros HaTorah. And that was really when I was really first introduced to Jewish history. I always enjoyed history. And so I gradually got into that. And it just ended up at this Twitter account and the podcast. I don't know if you want me to...
So it's through Jewish history that you landed in Svarim. That's basically how you got there.
Right, more or less. Like I said, my grandfather always collected Svarim. His house is wall to wall with Svarim. His shul, he always had a big oyster. He was always very into Svarim. But I never really took an interest as a kid. It's funny. I wasn't one of those 8 years old buying Svarim. Really not. It's only when I got into yeshiva in Philly. It happens to be. Like I said, now before I even went there, I was into it. But in Philly, it's a thing. Guys have a lot of Svarim. There's a Svarim closet where there's in yeshiva that would sell some Svarim. So I don't know. I got into Svarim there, and I was exactly. It was the history and the Svarim together. That really, I got this farm.
Okay, we won't hold it against you for not collecting Svarim as an 8-year-old. High school is a reasonable age to be starting such a hobby. Most people, I'm not sure if they know you more for the podcast or for the Twitter, but the Twitter account is obviously the precursor for the podcast, which basically it seems is you just kind of update new Svarim that are out, you put some pictures, give some info, you answer questions and where to get them. So how did that come into being?
Right. So I had a Jewish music account. It's not really in existence anymore. But back in the day, I was very into Jewish music. I would post new Jewish music. I got into that scene. It was like a big Jewish music Twitter scene. I don't know where it's holding nowadays, if it really is. So at one point, I was getting more into Sfar. I was in Lakewood. I was in Kail, I think. Yeah, I think I started it when I was already married in Kail. And so I decided, I was like looking around, and I would be interested in the Sfar. And it was really hard to come, but you had websites, but not where we are today. And even now, we're not where we should be. And, you know, so there was obviously things. You read the Sfarim blog, everybody knows, and you check out on the main line. But those are more articles. Those were not like new Sfarim posts. And I was like, what's new? What's coming out? People always go to the store. I remember, especially in Beis Aharon, it's not so updated in Yeshiva and BMG, they would have like new Sfarim shelf. And everyone always wants to see that. Like, what's the new Sfarim? Some shuls have it. There's no way to really find out, especially online. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to start a Twitter account. And the first few posts, go all the way back to the beginning, were just like with text. Like, this is what's coming out. And people were like, no, that's not like super interesting or whatever. So, and I actually remember I posted it. So I had this big Jewish music account. So I was posting there and like, hey, go follow my Sfarim account. And someone responded. He's like, why are you posting Sfarim on Twitter? Like, this is not the right place for this. Like, don't post this here. And I was like, no, why? People are interested in old things. Why shouldn't we put Sfarim here? And that's how I started. So I started posting. I don't know how it developed somewhat organically, where I was posting the front cover and then the Shaar Blad, the title page. And then for a while, I would post a contact information. I wanted people to be able to access, get the safer. And then I would post like maybe a sample picture, et cetera. A lot of the original pictures weren't so done. They're not super professional now, but they weren't done as well. Even though, like, sideways sometimes. They weren't, you know.
And these pictures you take yourself, you just walk into the store, flip open to the farm, snap exactly. A couple shots.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I would do it. Judaica Plaza in Lakewood, I should mention them. They're a very good store, and I would get a lot of stuff from there. Obviously, now I became friends with the Beagle Eisen, terrific, everybody knows, famous farm store. And so that's essentially what I would do. Now, it developed over time. I would start posting links. I would check a lot of the Israeli Sfarim places, especially the Mossad of Cook, and then their regular Sfarim, but then academic things they have on their website. And I should mention, so the academic kind of came from that. It became sort of Sfarim, and then history, and then
yeah, okay, that's where I want to go. So what's the criteria to make it onto the Sfarim Chatter? If I publish a Kundris in Yeshiva, do I get to get publicized on Sfarim Chatter?
So theoretically, yes. Because maybe someone's interested, but it depends. I don't get a hold of every kundris. So there's no – if it's a safer, I try to put it on. I don't want to have an opinion one way or the other, and I've sometimes gotten mad about certain Sfarim that we put on there. I have a couple of examples come to mind. Why are you putting this on? This person is this person is that. Because it's not really my place to judge. I post the stuff. You want to see it, great. If not, you know, I put it on there, and that's it. Now, gradually – it became into academic. So I would post things from, you know, Merkaz Zalman Shazar and Bar Ilan Press and Magnus Press and all those. And then I think it went this way. And then from there, it became the Jewish studies titles and the history. So Princeton University Press and Academic Studies Press, Penn Press, and all the other ones, Wayne State University Press, whatever academic presses, many of them.
So it's really a lot for you to keep up with. Meaning you have to keep up with the standard Yeshivas Forum and then, you know, the new edition, the critical editions, and then academic stuff, and then the Kabbalah stuff I see you put up sometimes. All different genres, and I'm sure this isn't all your areas of interest. But you have to accommodate everybody.
Right, and I'll be honest, I don't always know. People ask me a lot. I'll give an example. Something, Hasidus is not something I'm super into. I know. So Kabbalah also. So people ask me like, you know, they ask me about a safer or whatever. I'm like, I don't know anything about it. So sometimes I'll literally just even post the safer name. I try to post. So that's another thing I forgot to mention. I try to post the safer's name, and then I try to post the author's name, what it's about, what it's on, roughly. But just reading the cover, it's impossible for me to go in depth on all these farms. This is not possible. And exactly. So I try to keep the academic presses are easier because usually they have catalogs once a season and it's, you know, you can see what's in there and what's coming. So you don't have to check there all the time. A lot of the Israeli sites or Sfarim, you check all the time. The other thing is, but now like Jacob Plaza has a website, Big Laws, and I speak to get the Sfarim from them. Girsa Sfarim, so Nishalayim has an email where they send out new stuff. So I don't usually post their pictures. They actually have a watermark. It says Girsa. So I have sometimes and I'll write where it comes from. I don't like to take pictures without saying where it's from if I do that, but I'll know what's coming, although that's coming, you know? I mean, that's another thing I should mention. I post stuff in Eretz Yisrael and I always get, where can I get it? Why is it not here yet? So sometimes I make kind of like a tumult without meaning to, but
right. Right. Now, how many followers are you holding by today?
I have to check. It's like 2,600 or something. I mean, it kind of was slow in the beginning, and then it got bigger. But what's interesting is, and I don't know if you want to get to the podcast now.
Let's hold 1 minute. But just on the followers, I don't want to cut you off. But meaning at the size that you've reached right now, it probably makes sense for these publishers to reach out to you at a certain point to publicize this farm instead of you having to hustle around all these stores and taking pictures and whatnot.
You want to advocate
that happen?
You want to advocate that?
You know, if people are listening, listeners should know this, and this is really where you ought to be advertising.
Yeah, but right. On the other hand, no, I'm kidding. I mean, yes and no. I don't need to end up with a copy of every safer. I mean, it's not a lot of these farms don't interest me. Even Chashvas Farm, it's just not something I'm personally interested in. It's like, what am I going to do with it? So I mean, people offered to send me a safer. Sure,
But just through your medium, it'll reach other people. So.
Absolutely, that is true. So, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's more or less the Twitter account. And then I just want to point that also for listeners who may be in Lakewood, a lot of what appears on the Twitter account does appear in physical hard copy in Weinstein Shul on Fifth Street. So you can get more than just the pictures. Sometimes you can get actual safer. Okay, so from the Twitter, I guess at a certain point you decided to move into podcasting. About a year ago, and timing seemed to have been perfect because people were all looking for things to listen to and be entertained by. So how did that idea develop, and you know, what did you anticipate going into it, and where is that holding now?
So I may have said this on another old show, but like I said, we're doing it again, you know, in a different form. So at a certain point, I decided to do a podcast, and that was, I've actually been listening to podcasts for many years as a big sports fan. I listened to podcasts for many, many years, 10 years probably, and nobody was listening to podcasts. I mean, people were, but many people weren't. And I was probably a bigger sports fan back then than now, especially football and baseball. So I would listen to podcasts then. So I was always, you know, knew kind of podcasts, what they were, what was going on. At a certain point, it hit me about 2 years ago. Then I'm going to start a podcast. And I had a couple of different ideas. I was going to have a co-host. We were going to do it. And mainly it was going to be like what the Twitter account is. What's new in this farm world? What's coming out? And that kind of thing. Give a little talk about it, whatever. I've done a few of those and pretty positive feedback. For various reasons, it didn't work out. And mainly I started doing the LSAT then, preparing for law school, and just had no time and I shelved that. And part of that also, and to speak to this farm chatter podcast in general, is that that requires a lot of work. As I said, when people ask me about this farm, I don't know every single safer that I post. I mean, I see it, a fair bit of them maybe I know, but I don't know everything. It's impossible for me to know everything. And so even if a safer that I buy or that I'm interested in, or that I, and also there's farm that I'm not so interested in, but I buy for the shul because I know people interested in, for example, I have to do some research on it. I can't just get on a podcast and be like, oh, there's this new safer came out. I mean, I could kind of, but it's still going to take me 20 minutes, half an hour of time. And so that requires time and effort, and I have to sit down and just to do a podcast. That's one issue. Another issue is that you have to have enough content. I toyed with this idea in a lot of ways. Like, am I just doing a rapid fire segment on this is new, this is new, this is new? Or are we doing an in-depth about a new safer? Or are we combining the two? Are we having questions? Like, how is it going to go? And how's it going to translate to a podcast, like to audio only file? So it didn't really work. It didn't really get off the ground. A year ago, when everyone's in quarantine, with the COVID. And so I don't know, people were, I don't know. I just got there. I'm like, you know what? I'll go on Twitter live. I'm on Twitter, tap into the existing listener base. Let me just do a live show, Periscope live. And I just started doing live, taking questions. And I did like two of them and I got pretty good feedback. And I said, you know what? I'll have guests. And I had, I think Israel Mizrahi was my first guest of the Mizrahi Farm Store. And then I had Dov Bashefkin, Shimon Steinmetz on the main line. And then JJ Schachter, who Menachem Butler coordinated that. That was like the first, I guess, academic guest, as far as I remember. And my friend Shimon Shimanowitz was Machon Ali Zayas. I mean, it slowly started. And at that point, so it was even then, like I said, it developed really just organically. It was supposed to be one thing, and then it became kind of something else.
Right. I mean, you started talking directly about farm, which is, I guess, what you project to do. But it seems that at a certain point, you branched out, you know, in terms of academics and also just things that don't relate necessarily to farm, but let's say specific topics. Jewish history, Jewish studies, and you know, things that are contained within.
Right. So as I mentioned about myself, how did I get into it? It's because I was into history and Sfarim, and they really overlap, especially if you're into older Sfarim. I mean, a lot of people into Heintige stuff. They like Halacha. They like Lamdas. That's not really history. But a lot of people into older Sfarim as myself, and old Sfarim, I don't only mean antiques. I mean, you know, even new editions, but of, you know, Sfarim from Mechabrim a few hundred years ago, Rishayim and onward, and even Gainim, whatever, pick wherever you want. So I was into history. So I decided that, like I said, to do the podcast, the live even was about originally about the Sfarim, and then it just developed. And even then, right, if you see, I got Mizrahi and I had Shemanowitz. I had people on that were about Sfarim, and then it just like I said, it gradually went. It became, I was like, you know what? And I think the point I was trying to make is that people are interested in Sfarim, into history a lot. So I said, you know what? Let's blend it and let's get into both. And I try, it's usually based on a book. So it's like some sort of book review, or it's based on Sfarim. I try to ask, well, there's sometimes about further reading otherwise. And I try to somehow have it based loosely on Sfarim or books. But it's not always. It's really kind of developed. So, I mean, it says in the show's description, I mean, what is the show? It's kind of a mix. It's Sfarim and history. It's kind of both those things, I guess. So does that mean it has no direction? I don't think so. I think it kind of has, you know, both. And I should step back for a second before you want to ask me something else, that from there, I just did those periscopes. And then gradually, as, you know, quarantine wound down, people started getting out, whatever. Actually, before that, I had people tell me, why don't you upload them to podcasts? People want podcasts. And like I said, I was a big podcast listener. People want podcasts. So I eventually did, and people really liked it. And at a certain point, I was like, you know what? Let's forget the live show. It's hard to coordinate with the guests, especially guests in Eretz Yisrael. The live show was good because it was on my Twitter feed and people could ask questions live, but I was like, you know what? Forget it. So I went to do it over Zoom, and now everyone knows how to use Zoom. So in that way, you know, I don't think such a podcast, really, I don't think it would have been able to be even a few years ago. And one professor that I had on told me that, you know, they never would have done this. They didn't really use technology so much, and they wouldn't have agreed necessarily to go on Zoom and just do something like this. So in that way, it's helped. Obviously, COVID overall is not a good thing. I'm just saying that it would help. So gradually it ended up where we are. It's just
right. And I'm sure that greatly increased listeners and all, you know, feel some live and much more accessible at that point. Could you throw some numbers as to the average podcast episode? I don't know which ones were the better ones, but how many listeners do you have?
You're asking questions. I'm supposed to give an answer to that. No, but okay. I can. It's fine. It's not, The numbers, I'm not a math guy, so I didn't have, you know, actually count it up. But the average listener, it's around 1,000 now, 900 to 1,000 on a standard podcast, which to me, I'm blown away. Because to me, this is more of a niche product. It's not pop culture we're talking about. We're talking about Sfarim and history. And it's really gotten a lot of listeners. You know, there's certain ones, you know, Aaron Lapiansky, that podcast has over 2,000 listens.
That was the most popular podcast?
Yeah. And now his son went and put it up on their website, Eshel Publications. So it's there. So that helped it. I know Rabbi David Katz has a podcast. He went and he talked about it in a recent episode. I mean, there's other ones. I mean, Rabbi Shua Hartman on the Maral, people has over 1,500. Obviously, Professor Rabbi Kanterfogel has both. I did one on Taisus, one on Rashi, and Mirtz Hashem will do another one. I'll say that here. We are doing another one. I have a topic already, Mirtz Hashem. So that has tremendous, over 1,400. Listening to some of the rationale.
It's very impressive because, you know, we're in a time where it seems like every other guy is starting a new firm podcast. And I saw even the comments of on social media that it seems that they're just recycling speakers at a certain point because we don't have enough to go around. But meanwhile, you've managed to rack up a list of very impressive interviewees. And
very
impressive.
Yes, I try. Listen, another thing about the podcast has developed is people have asked me, I'll have on a mechaber or an editor or an academic, and they're like, oh, this academic wrote books on all these things. Talk about all these things. No, that's not going to work on the podcast for a few reasons. First of all, I found over time, as it's defined, it's more strict, rigidly defined, the podcast flows better, and I think it's a better listen. Listeners can tell me otherwise. By the way, anyone can email me, swarmchatter@gmail.com, any comments. So I think it flowed better. Like that. Another thing was, I started realizing at a certain point, Eliezer Brutt, who's a good friend of mine through Sfarim and of the podcast, and he told me, I think it was him, actually. I don't know, maybe he's listening to this. I think it was him. So, you know, you can run out of guests, him or someone else. So I said, you know, it's a good idea. It's right. So I started thinking, well, if like I did with Professor Canifogel, we can have one on Tysis, one on Rashi, one on this. We can have a lot of people that come on wrote more than one book. Professor Schiffman, Professor Lawrence Schiffman, I had him on Dead Sea Scrolls, and then we did on Hanukkah. And all those things, so as I split them up, it makes the podcast more defined and allows me for more guests. It's not the same thing. I'm not recycling. I mean, totally new topic. And that's why sometimes you get it specific. So when I had Professor Robert Brody, recently, we did on the Goyim overall based on his book. And people are like, what about Saji Goyim? What about his work on Tesefta? But it doesn't go. Then there's just you're grabbing everything and you're ruining the topic on another one if he would be so kind as to come back on. But it doesn't flow well. So that's, I don't know if I'm answering your question, just answering, talking a lot about the podcast in general.
Oh, no, it's so good. So I want to segue into this, just the speakers that you've chosen. So first of all, how do you find people to interview on the podcast? What are your criteria? And then how do you reach out to them and get them to agree to come on?
So you're asking some complicated questions. So the original speaker list was just people that I knew. I know Israel Mizrahi, buy from him, great store. Adava Bashafkin's a friend. Shimon Steinmetz is a friend. Shimon Shimanowitz. And so I knew them. Menachem Butler, who everyone knows, I did not know Menachem, who's terrific. Menachem went and hooked me up with Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schechter. And so that was like the first academic. And so... I don't know if other ones, at a certain point, I don't know a lot. Then I went and I was emailed, blind emails. You send emails to them. Hi, I read your book. I have this program. Would you be so kind as to come on? And many of them were like, sure. They want to promote their scholarship and their book. And something else I should point out is, I hope I achieve this. I try to gear these towards the general public. I don't know exactly who the listeners are, but I try. It should be for general public. Sometimes you take these are, historians, or like I said, even a machaber, they're in a specific field, and sometimes it doesn't come across as the general public. And I want it that it should be trying to. They should know more about the scholarship, and if it's a topic they're interested in, obviously something they're not interested in, then fine. So I email them. At a certain point, I don't know. You have a certain list, and just I don't know when you get to that point, and it's like, okay, all these other ones went on. Oh, I'll of course agree. I'm not talking for them, but maybe that helps.
Right. Once you have you establish yourself, you have a certain name for yourself.
Right.
And then the rest comes easier.
Now, who, as for who, listen, I'm open to everything. I want it to be men and women, guests who are experts in their field, book, but it could be anything. It could be, I think it says in the description where it could be a historian, a machaber, an editor, someone who sells farm, anything. Now, it's not so, I always tell people the reason why I don't have necessarily so many machaberis farm is a few reasons. First of all, many people live in Israel, they don't speak English, so that's not obviously a possibility. Also, your classical sefer on say any lamdash or sugi on Meitav or on whatever pick a sugi that you want is not really exciting for a podcast. That's not something that I would do. So it has to be something historical or about a safe, something a little bit more interesting. Now I am doing, and there are some more coming that are going to be start a little bit more book review type, but I feel like there's more what to talk about there. So.
Right, so I would add also Mechaber Swarm. It could be that a lot of the popular Swarm, the Mechaber would not come on a Zoom podcast.
I meant to say, yeah, and the internet, that's another thing. So people should know behind the scenes, I have efforted many Mechaberim. I've tried. As it's Pesach time now. I just released, I thought it was a very good episode, the game with Professor Sabar on the Sarajevo Haggadah, but that's a certain niche product, especially. And so I tried to get on Mahadir or editor of a new edition of Haggadah, but it just didn't work. I tried.
Yeah, you said you have a grassroots effort to infiltrate the Lakewood and Eretz Yisrael worlds of anti-Zoom.
I'm not trying to. I absolutely understand if people don't want to. It's totally not something that I'm trying to do, but it's like, that's why I don't get them. But bottom line is I'm open to a wide variety. I want it to be different opinions, and it's the guests' opinions, by the way. Sometimes people, have them on, have their opinions, and try to, get a wide range. So there's no criteria. I don't have a specific criteria.
Right, and as you mentioned, that two of the more popular podcasts were Rabbi Lopiansky and Rabbi Hartman. So I just wonder, meaning they're fascinating people, but they're also people that we're all very, let's say your average yeshiva guys are familiar with. It's not something so far out like one of these. Professors talking about the Rishonim and, critical editions of various Svarim. So what is that? How do you interpret that when you get, that type of popularity for those podcasts?
I think it's what you're saying. I think maybe, I don't know. So I'm not an analyst, a data analyst, right? I don't know. Maybe it tells you something about the listeners. Like I said, the listeners are more people that are interested in that. I don't know. Also, like I said, those were promoted in other places, in various places, also maybe helped it. There are, right. There are a number of, there's many academic podcasts, well over 1,000 listeners. So, you know, it's been, people definitely are interested. I think it has to do so much with the topic as well. I think that also has to do with it.
So you definitely have a spectrum. That's what it sounds like. You definitely have a wide spectrum of listeners. That
right. I'll point out, I had a podcast with Dan Klein and Shadal, almost has 1,300 listens. Now you'll say, well, Shadal's interesting. Yeah, a lot of people didn't know maybe who he was. And I had, it also, I'll point out something else. And this is not a slight in any of my guests. I'm just saying this as a general global comment. As someone told me as a feedback, and I agree with this as the host, if it's an engaging guest, I think the podcast, as a podcast, I mean, I've listened to podcasts, like I said, a few times for many years, if, as a podcast, it's not just like a rigid interview. If it's an engaging guest, then a boring topic will be entertaining. If the guest is not engaging for whatever reason, it's not necessarily going to go over as well and not be as popular. So I think it somewhat has to do with the guests. Sometimes it has to do with the topic. People like certain topics. They find it very interesting. There's a lot more to say there. And people enjoy them. So I think it's kind of both. Also, the podcast earlier on, definitely the subscriber list has grown and the amount of people that know about the podcast has grown. So the newer podcast just get.
You got a nice recommendation on Soren blog a couple months ago.
Yeah, Professor Mark Shapiro. He also, I had him earlier on. So I had been in contact with him. So he agreed to come on. Exactly. At the beginning, it was kind of someone made the connection or I knew them. And then I just started emailing professors. So like back to your question, I just email people and they agreed to come on.
Okay, so my next question is probably a lot of people are wondering, how do you prepare yourself for a podcast? I mean, each, you know, especially the topical ones, you focus on a specific issue and you have to all of a sudden be very familiar with this person's personal thesis. So how do you get ready for that?
So thank you for bringing that up. It's something that I was started on mentioning and saying a lot here, so I forgot about that. Part of the reason why my regular idea of a podcast didn't work is because it requires too much effort. And like I said, I don't really have the time for that. But when you have a guest-centric podcast, the onus is on the guest, not on me. So now you can still ask, well, what do you mean? You still have to know the specifics, you have to know what's going on. So that's true. But first of all, some of the stuff I know a fair bit of. I at least well-read. Now, it doesn't mean I know in and out of every single thing. I am not the guest, but I know enough to facilitate a conversation. I think and I hope I've gotten better at that over time. It's been a learning experience for me doing the podcast and how I am and still is. How to be a good host and you know, where to lead the guests to. Sometimes ask general questions more and then more specific questions. But then there are various ones that I read, you know, read their stuff before. So, you know, I'll tease an upcoming episode. I don't know when it's going to come out yet. Professor Neil Nathanel, who's a law professor in UCLA, and he wrote a book, From Maimonides to Microsoft. It's about history of Jewish copyright law. So I'm in law school and it's farm. It's great. And obviously the big thing there was with the Bragadini, Giustiniani fight over the Moran Padua, over the Rambam and the printing in 1550. And so that was something that I kind of knew the story, but I read his book before. And that, you know, I really learned more. So I was able to prepare for the podcast. And something else I wanted to point out, you know, from these podcasts, there are many times I learn a lot from the podcast and sometimes I do read to prepare. Professor Brody on the Guinan, I had known of his book, I had glanced at it, but I actually read most of it before the podcast. There's a couple other ones that I'm reading now, but I do have to prepare for some of them. And some of them I get help. But, you know, I should mention, I had Professor Benny Brown on the Muslim movement and Yehuda Geber of Jewish History Soundbites, who I interviewed, he helped me out with some of those questions. And some I was able to come up with myself and some he helped. So I do have people giving input and helping out. But yeah, there is some preparation involved and some things I'm interested in. You know, the Sfarno, for example, I had Moshe Kravitz. The Sfarno is something that I'm very into Italian Jewry. It's something that interests me. So I kind of, I don't know if I knew a lot of it, but a lot of those questions at least to ask, like I said, every specific thing the guest is going to say that I know, no, but enough to do facilitate a conversation. I think a lot of some of these topics I did, and the other ones, I try to read the books, and you know, you try to. Wow. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. Okay, sure. And then, looking forward, so do you? Let's say, do you feel like you've run through the list already, or there's a lot more out there in terms of future interviews?
So I'll just say here, I already have around 8 that are recorded at this point that haven't been released yet. And then there's been many, many more guests that agreed. And like I said, there's going to be returning guests. I can already, I'll say it here. I'm not promising at any time, but Professor Kanner Fogel is going to come back. We're actually going to do a podcast, Nimitz Shem, the Planets of the Mordechai. And then Rabban Lapiansky is actually publishing Machzerim for Shem Kippur, a new edition. So he's going to, Nimitz Shem, I hope that he'll come back and we'll talk about, you know, a smaller podcast on that. And so there's going to be returning guests on different topics. And as well as, you know, there's many more. There's many, many more topics. And I hope to, eventually, I guess you run out. But for now, I hope that I'm still able to, and definitely people still seem to be interested. And I will mention here again, as we wind down, that please email me any comments, suggestions, constructive criticism, appreciated at svarimchatter@gmail.com. Also, I should mention, I guess, sponsorship opportunities are available.
Yes, for the podcast. Sponsorship is available.
And guest
this
ideas.
This episode be sponsored.
And guest ideas are available as well. You know, I'm always willing to take guest ideas. That someone just emailed me the other day. I'm always willing to and to try to see how we can work it out. And yeah.
Okay. Now, just a few quick questions as we close up. Let's say you manage one of the outstanding libraries of Lakewood, as was mentioned. When you walk into a base manager, an Eitzer Svarim, or a library, what would tell you that this is a very good library? If you saw something or you see a type of organization.
That's a very complicated question. It really requires a separate podcast, but it depends. It depends because what does it mean a good library? To most people listening, you want to go into shul, you want to have the basics. I mean, I have my neighborhood here in Toms River where I live. I'm in charge of this farm here now. I do it, you know, for the neighborhood, and it's not. And we have the basics, you know, Gemaras. You need to make sure there's, you know. So
well, people come to Weinstein Shul. Let's say they like to browse. It's like almost it's known, has an unofficial name. It's like the burnt out base medrash of BMG.
So that's right. So that's something that I try to facilitate that way, though. I try to have a new shelf. I try to bring. We have many. We have thousands of svarim, and that was done that way. You know, I should say Baruch Hashem. My parents sponsored this farm there, and they wanted it to be an Eitzer like that. So it's something that it came out that way. But in a regular shul, I'm not dodging the question. Just in a regular shul that you walk into, if they have a nice standard Eitzer to your regular average person, that's a good library. So I don't want to knock it. Now, is it arranged properly? If the place is just upside down, even they got their, you know, they have Chumash is next to the Ksais and there's Gemara, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. That's not good. It should have basic organization. That's something else that I mean, or it doesn't have to be fancy organization, but like basically organized. So, you know, many shuls have a decent library, but a comprehensive one, you know, I learned a lot in Robert's shul in Lakewood, which they have a, you know, pretty good library. There are a bunch of shuls in Lakewood. So I'm kind of dodging your question, but like it depends. It's not just a one size fits all answer.
Right. Okay. And you obviously buy a lot of farm, a lot of books. How many bookcases do you have in your house?
Yeah, there was a AMA, right? Ask me anything Twitter that I did. So I have 17 bookcases in my basement and a couple upstairs.
Leonhard, Ken Yerba, wow.
Yeah, Leonhard, Baruch Hashem. And I've changed a lot. People have seen I've sold a lot of stuff. That's because I changed. I got a lot more defined. You know, when you're younger, you just buy this and you buy that. You're interested in different things and that changes. So, I've been interested in various different svarim at different times. And yeah.
Very good. Okay. Thank you, Nachi Weinstein, for joining us on Svarim Chatter. And mazel tov on the first anniversary.
I guess joining on yeah. Success. Yeah, and Mirtz Hashem, we'll do many more. Like I said, if anybody has comments, suggestions, please email me, svarimchatter@gmail.com. And thank you for doing the interview.